Programs at CNA in the Safety and Security Division, and Project Director for the Bureau of Justice Assistance Body-Worn Camera Technical Assistance Program. In honor of the one-year anniversary of the Bureau of Justice Assistance Body-Worn Camera podcast series, we're going to do things a bit differently for this podcast. We're asking several of our frequent podcast hosts to serve as interviewees. They will update us on the Bureau's body-worn camera efforts and provide us with an update on research occurring around body-worn cameras. Today, I'm speaking with Michael Russa, Senior Policy Advisor for the Bureau of Justice Assistance, Dr. Michael White, Professor at Arizona State University, and Todd Maxwell, Subject Matter Expert on the Bureau of Justice Assistance's body-worn camera team. Mike Russa is a Senior Policy Advisor for the Bureau of Justice Assistance Policy Office. As an experienced technology implementer and data integrator, Mr. Russa's portfolio includes the body-worn camera pilot implementation program, technical analysis for the Violence Reduction Network, and the Technology Innovations for Public Safety program. Previously, Mr. Russa was the Chief Information Officer for the Maryland State Police. Michael White is a professor in the School of Criminology and Criminal Justice at Arizona State University. He serves as the director of the school's PhD program, as the associate director of the University Center for Violence Prevention and Community Safety, and as the co-director of the Bureau of Justice Assistance Body-Worn Camera Technical Assistance Program. He received his PhD in criminal justice from Temple University in 1999. Prior to entering academia, Dr. White worked as a deputy sheriff in Pennsylvania. Dr. White's primary research interests involve the police, including use of force, training, and misconduct. His recent work has been published in Justice Quarterly, Criminal Justice and Behavior, Criminology and Public Policy, and Crime and Delinquency. Todd Maxwell is a consultant for Booz Allen Hamilton and works on-site at the Bureau of Justice Assistance as a technology subject matter expert, advising them on policy related to technology topics, including body-worn cameras, video analytics and redaction, implementation strategies, software integration, cloud solutions, and emerging technologies. He is a member of the Bureau's body-worn camera team that created the body-worn camera toolkit and a frequent host of the Bureau's body-worn camera podcast series. Now let's begin with Mike Russa. Mike, it's been a busy year at BJA in regards to the grants, podcast solicitations, and body-worn camera technical assistance. A big part of the Bureau's body-worn camera efforts involves funding solicitations, and BJA released solicitations in 2015 and 2016 for body-worn cameras. Can you give our listeners an overview of the solicitations for those 2 years?
Great. Thanks, Chip. I'd love to, and thanks for having turning it this way. This sounds like a fun interview. The solicitations are obviously important to us. They're a big part of the program. I think we're over 40-some-odd million right now put out by BJA to the nation to support body-worn camera programs. Some of that's TTA. Some of that has been the development of the toolkit in those areas. But the lion's share of these funds have really been to implement body-worn cameras at the local agency, and dealing, fortunately, dealing with people such as Dr. White, who joins us today, we had a strong base of knowledge that we felt we could build on the existing knowledge that was there, and continue to develop these programs. So really, what we've done is focused on implementations based on agency size and agency readiness, going through those areas. A few areas we've focused on partnerships between agencies. To try to leverage economies of scale on purchasing, since this is obviously such an expensive endeavor, as most agencies have found. Additionally, the relationship, the strong impact on the criminal justice system means you have to have relationships with more of the criminal justice system. So we require a strong relationship with prosecutions, judicial system, even advocacy groups. And since this is a transparency and community-driven program, those advocacy groups really play a big role in it. So in the 2 years, we've done technically 3 solicitations, just agency 25 to as large as they get in 2015, where we released about $23 million in funds, purchased about 21,000 cameras for agencies, or they're in the process of purchasing those as the 2-year grant. This year we did it a little bit differently. We recognized the gap for agencies that are below 25 officers, and we'll, I'm sure, discuss that a little bit later, but that second solicitation was really important to help us learn about agencies, and that's what we do with a lot of the solicitations, is we use it as a learning base to pull knowledge from these agencies as they work. And then this year with the 2016 BWC TIF, which is the Policy and Implementation Program, that's the short name for the solicitation, we've made over 100 awards this year, a lot of them for small agencies, a lot of them for the four agency sizes that we've used. And that's another 17,000 cameras implemented. So in 2 years, we've received over 490 applications. We've been asked for $85 million in funds. Again, we only had 40 to issue, and we've made basically about 179 awards for that $40 million, which actually targets about 38,000 cameras in the end. So we're looking forward to it, and we're hoping to continue next year given funding, and we keep moving forward.
Thanks. It's actually quite amazing how you stood that program up on such a short amount of time, so the Bureau deserves a lot of credit for that. I wonder if you might just talk a little bit more about the reasoning behind creating the new solicitation for under 25 agencies.
So 2016, we really did have a strong focus, always have from BJA, on agencies of all sizes. And if you recognize the fact that the majority of law enforcement officers in the nation work for an agency with under 10 officers, or particularly under 25 officers, that's an important impact. And we realized that while they could partner together and submit applications, and we had a few in 2015 that actually did that, so agencies smaller than 25 officers standing together to submit a large enough application for us to do, did work, but we didn't quite get as many as we had hoped for. So putting out this particular solicitation that focused on agencies under 25, there's two main goals. One is to get more of them into the mix and to be able to work with more and help distribute the funds that way, and to be fair to all law enforcement agencies as we try to be. The second was actually recognizing the gap in grant ability, let's say, the ability to complete grants. Some small agencies are certainly very good at it. I don't mean to detract their ability, but the broad, how many agencies there are a lot of them that don't understand the grant process. Having a separate solicitation allowed us to simplify the process, get some of the overhead off of it, and push those grants out. There's still a lot of requirements. It's a complex process, a complex program, as you'll hear later, but in general sense, the idea was to help small agencies be able to focus on what's crucial to small agencies that might not be impactful for larger agencies.
Good. Makes a lot of sense. Now let's talk about something different for a minute. From your perspective, and we know that there'll be opportunities for additional solicitations in the future. What kind of advice or what are some best practices in applying for these grants that you might offer to our listeners?
Let me start with the biggest mistakes we see. I suppose that's the easiest way is to describe the grant process method. We open the grant for a certain period of time, and then when the grant closes, we don't take any more applications, and there are no updates to that application. So you have until the deadline to get your grant in. After that point, the peer reviewers kick in. Peer reviewers are people like you and me and anybody else from a local agency that signs up to do peer reviewing. They're paid peer reviewers, but they come from typically law enforcement or prosecution or researchers' backgrounds, and they work for other agencies. They are not full-time employees of the federal government. And their reviewers, that's really who you're writing to first. So that understanding as you write your application that it's not the federal government that you're really writing to convince that your application is good is very important. After the peer reviewers give us scores, then we take over and look at the requirements of the grant and other components and make sure you're lined up even based on the scores and issue the funding decisions based on that. So some of the areas that agencies we want to make sure they do. I won't say it's the biggest mistake, but it's certainly a shame to see. They don't start early enough. They don't make the deadline, and they don't ensure that their grant accounts in GMS, the grants management system, are fully set up and vetted so that they can be sure they submit. What this causes is last-minute mistakes, a failure to submit documents that may have been developed but not submitted. And we hate to see an application sit on the floor because the document just wasn't sent to us. after closing, to be fair to the other applicants, we can't accept additional documentation. So we have to work early on this, identify when it comes out, and focus on getting the package together and try to submit a few days earlier. I'd say 5, maybe a week early, because what happens is any problem that we see with an application, we do review it for basic necessities. We actually will respond, or if there was a problem submitting, a few days gives you time to work through that, and that prevents you from having to go into an appeal process. Otherwise, it's reading the entire application before you start working on it. Understand what the requirements. I recommend using a highlighter, going through and highlighting areas. Anytime you see something that says required or mandatory, make sure you have that section. There's several pieces of the solicitation that give you outlines of how the application works, how the solicitation is supposed to be done. An important note is that often the peer reviewers use the same order that we put in the solicitation. So when you're writing an application, agencies should focus on using the same order that we provided in the solicitation. That'll help to make it easier for the peer reviewers to actually find the data that you're looking for. This is how they grade or score an application. So make sure that you go through the process, make sure it's complete, try to keep it in the same order. Two other things, I'll try to keep it somewhat short. The budget worksheet and budget narrative are technically two different documents. They can be worked together. The budget worksheet is actually where you have your line item cost of expected cost. They don't have to be final cost. The budget narrative explains line by line. They can be worked together, but they do have to be informative and give the peer reviewer an understanding of what you're trying to buy and how it relates to the program. The other piece would be, the file names of the files you upload. Try to make them descriptive. That helps the peer reviewers and us to identify the areas that we're looking for. You'll be loading multiple files with this application. The best example I can give is a requirement that we've had every year so far, and it's just getting more emphatic on it because of we see the need for this, which is the prosecutor support documentation. There's actually two attachments that I expect to be in this year, but I won't be able to review that until we actually have the solicitation finalized, and that's if we get the posted based on funding. But that is actually an MOU or some formal document that identifies that a prosecution, the prosecutor is involved with the program, that they have eyes open going into this. It's not going to surprise them that the agency has started a program. The second one is actually we've identified the importance of use of force. And we're actually going to require the agency to make a statement that they've identified that they will review their use of force policy if they don't already have a regular periodic process for this review. And it's just because we want to help agencies maintain the security of recognizing the need for that policy. Don't assume that the peer reviewers know what you're talking about. Don't use acronyms where they might not make sense or other areas. But at the same time, as you're trying to describe something complex, still try to be brief. The longest we've had is 20 pages for these solicitations, which would be the application length. We've gone down to 10 for small agencies trying to simplify it. Somewhere in the middle is what you're focused on. Don't use all 20 if you don't have to. Just explain the program as best you can in words that if you were talking to another agency that they would understand why the need is there and how it's going to be a success for your agency. That's really the gamut of grant applications. There's always other pieces. Never be afraid to call. Make sure you attend the webinars for the grant, usually a couple of days, maybe a week after the solicitation is posted. BJA will host a webinar that reviews it. Particularly in this case, we're fortunate we have CNA as the TTA provider. Agencies looking to submit applications should certainly reach out to them and figure out what are best practices that they should make sure they work with and going on those areas. But given all that, I would say I expect a lot of good applications next year should we get to post it.
Good. That's sound practical advice, Mike. Thank you. One last question for you, if you don't mind. Can you just talk a little bit about the range of technical assistance resources and services that are provided through the Bureau's program? And maybe talk a little bit about what's available to non-grantees as well as grantees.
Thank you. I appreciate that, Chip. That's a really important aspect. It's something we recognize. While we may have dealt with 500 agencies and we've awarded almost 200 agencies, we can take that to the number of approximately 18,000 agencies, we're a drop in the bucket overall. So the non-grantees is really important, but we need the grantees to help gather information. So the biggest difference is grantees, of course, are receiving funds. So all the federal mandates and requirements that go with receiving funds kick in. There's a periodic reporting that's necessary, which is really programmatic and fiscal reporting. The TTA provider assists with the reporting of achievements, of milestones met, and going through those areas. Plus, there's a special conditions component. Anytime you receive a grant from BJA, there'll usually be some type of special condition. Body-worn cameras particularly usually has a policy special condition, which means you have to have gone through what we call a policy development review process. CNA leads that effort and works with the agencies to do that review and help them. It's not that we're dictating policy, but we're just ensuring that the policy has been considerate of the breadth needed for such a complex policy. I'm going through those. For non-grantees and for everybody, this is where it really kicks in, and the benefit of having a TTA provider that's funded, so there won't be any required match or required requests for the agency to put in funds to do this. You make the call, you send the email, and we'll give that in a little bit. Then you get access to the services that are provided. The best way to make sure it's clear, and particularly if I misspeak, bwcTTA.com. The best place to go, you can look through what the resources are and how to get there, how to contact agencies and what's really available. Mainly, if you have a question about body-worn camera programs, whether it's on implementation, policy development, advocacy and outreach, any area that you might have a question on, what are the expected costs and you know, what's the best company? And we're not going to answer that question particularly for you, but you're going to have that question. What we can do is, and through TTA, is provide you with peers that have worked with multiple companies, and you can have that conversation and ensure that you get through that discussion with other relevant subject matter experts. Additionally, and this is one of the real strengths that I like about what CNA has done for us, is set up the Speakers Bureau. So if you have a regional meeting going on and you need a subject matter expert to really talk about some of the areas, might be about prosecution or implementation or even budgeting for a body-worn camera program, contact us. We will see. If we can do it over the phone, we'll keep it cheap and do it over the phone. It's very good information. Information goes that way. But if you need somebody on site for something, and usually we have some size to it. Regional is better than just sitting for a single agency that we could usually do over the phone. Please call, ask for a representative to come out, a subject matter expert on a particular area, and provide that service. It's really been a good benefit, and providing that information is what BJA's focus is for this.
This concludes part one of our podcast today in honor of the one-year anniversary of the Bureau of Justice Assistance Body-Worn Camera podcast series.